I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you again to this month's edition of Headliners. As you know, this monthly forum focuses on stories in the headlines or on research that's making national news. And tonight, we're fortunate to be joined by a leading economist who will actually do both. On October 15th, it was announced that University of Minnesota Regents Professor Emeritus Leonid Hurwitz won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his pioneering work in a branch of game theory known as mechanism design. In one of numerous interviews about his colleague, Vivi Chari acknowledged Leo Hurwitz as a Renaissance man who revolutionized the way people think about economic outcomes. At age 90, Hurwitz is the oldest Nobel Prize winner in history. The celebration of this long overdue recognition came in the middle of a steady stream of bad news about the subprime mortgage and credit market crises, rising oil and food prices, and the declining value of the U.S. dollar. As the Nobel laureates assemble in Sweden for next week's award ceremonies, we have the opportunity to understand the significance of the groundbreaking theory that garnered this year's prize in economics, and then to enter into a discussion about the volatile state of today's economy with one of this country's leading experts on financial crises. Let me introduce Vivi Chari. Vivi Chari holds the Paul W. Frenzel Land-Grant Chair in Economics at the University of Minnesota. Born and educated in India, he earned a Ph.D. from Carnegie Mellon University in 1981, where he received the Alexander Henderson Award for the best dissertation in economics. In 1986, he moved to the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, where he continues to serve as a senior research officer and economic advisor. He joined the faculty of the University of Minnesota Economics Department in 1994 and served as its chair from 1997 to 2000. His research interests are in fiscal and monetary policy and issues of economic development, and he's written and lectured extensively on banking crises. Please join me in welcoming Professor Vivi Chari.
Thank you, Mary. It's a great pleasure to be here. Today I thought I'd talk briefly about one of my personal heroes, Leo Hurwitz. I have known Leo for roughly 26 years, since the early 80s. Leo has always been the most stimulating colleague, the most fascinating person to talk about any subject under the sun, and the deepest thinker I have ever known. So for those of you who don't know Leo, it's actually not that old. It's maybe about 4 or 5 years old. It shows Leo characteristically, the blackboard behind him is filled with lots of things. His office is always difficult to walk into because you have to step over books and papers which are piled all over the place. And there's only one office at the University of Minnesota that is more disorganized than Leo's, and that's mine. But he is the quintessential academic. The best way I can think about describing Leo is he was a scholar, he was a teacher, and he was a Renaissance man. As a scholar, he founded what's called modern econometrics, which is the study use of statistical methods to study economic questions. He founded mechanism design. When I refer to the four words that changed the world, the four words are mechanism design and incentive compatibility. I'll spend a little bit of time explaining, or trying to explain in English rather than Greek, what those words mean. As a teacher, Leo had countless students formally whom he advised, but my guess is there are roughly about 3,000 economic theorists in the world, and every one of them would acknowledge Leo as his or her teacher. Among other things, Leo built a great department. It's a department that Leo joined in 1951, and he took it from a mediocre little collection of offices in the then business school to one of the departments that's ranked as in the top 10 across the world. And a lot of it was Leo along with Walter Heller. Leo Hurwitz and Walter Heller really built that department because of their openness to intellectual inquiry, because of their refusal to treat ideology as important, because of their insistence that honesty and integrity in research and teaching and outreach were central. Leo was a committed Democrat, but he committed member of the DFL party. But my guess is he hired more Republicans in the department than DFLers. That's the kind of person Leo was. Leo was a Renaissance man. The best way of describing this is to tell a story about the very first time I met Leo. It was at a party. I was visiting Minnesota at the time, and my advisor from Carnegie Mellon, who had just joined Minnesota, Ed Prescott, who subsequently won the Nobel Prize, hosted a party, and I was there at the party, and this was the first time I was meeting the great Professor Hurwitz. And Leo asked me, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from India." He said, No. "Where in India?" I said, "I'm from Tamil Nadu," which is a state in India. He said, No. "Where in Tamil Nadu?" So I said, "I come from a small village near a small town called Pudukkottai." He said, Yes, I know Pudukkottai. Then he launched for the next 45 minutes with me. I was a young assistant professor just out of graduate school. There were all these famous people around, but Leo focused on me. And he had a deep, penetrating discussion. It wasn't a discussion. It was an instruction into the details of the Tamil language, my mother tongue. Right? And so he explained to me subtleties about my own language that I had not appreciated and that I did not know. And so I went home and I called my father up and I said, "Did you know all of these things?" He said, "How did you know these things? I never taught you any of this stuff." And I told him about Leo, and he did meet Leo when he visited, and Leo and he had long discussion about a variety of things in India. That was the kind of person Leo was. He knew everything about everything. I tried to mimic, to pattern myself after Leo, so I pretend I know everything about everything. But people find me out really fast. So what I found fascinating about this is here is a Jewish professor from Poland talking to an immigrant from India about the details of Tamil, about Indonesian villages. It was just fascinating. Leo was born during World War I in Moscow, where his family had fled during the war. He graduated from Warsaw University. In 1940, he came to Chicago and had distant relatives and lived in a small corner of a small living room, waiting to get a job. Somehow, he wrote to Paul Samuelson, who already by this time was a very famous economist, and Samuelson, sensing something here, hired him as an RA, and subsequently he was a research assistant to Oscar Lange, and I'll have something to say about Oscar Lange. In 51, as I said, he moved to Minnesota, and he had a whole stream of contributions, but the two contributions cited by the Nobel Committee and universally acknowledged as being central are the innovation of two terms, mechanism design and incentive compatibility. In the early 70s. He has a long string of honors, as you'd imagine, for such a distinguished person. So before I get to the details of what Leo did, let me step back for a minute. The fundamental normative question in economics is, how do we figure out what's best for, in according to some criterion, and how do we get there? And this question is a question that economists have struggled with for a long time. And economists always had an uneasy feeling that that was the wrong question to ask. They weren't quite sure why it was the wrong question to ask until Leo came along. When Leo came along, he said, that's not the right question to ask. The right question to ask is, how do we set up a system, a set of rules for social interaction that would generate the best outcomes? Let us not ask where we want to go. Let us use the information people have in order to figure out where they want to go. Now, in thinking about things this way, I think this is partly mind reading. You have to remember that Leo by the way, you should know that Leo does not have a PhD in economics. He has a law degree. It's a tribute to the openness of our profession. But I think the law degree played an important role in this because he was used to thinking not in terms of outcomes, but rather in terms of process. The great debate of the 1930s and the 1940s in economics, one of the great debates, was a debate between Friedrich Hayek and Oscar Lange on what would happen under a centrally planned economic system. And Lange insisted that centrally planned economic systems could function well. And Hayek said, no, they cannot. They will not. And Hayek argued that the main reason why centrally planned systems could not function well is because no single person has all the information needed to get the whole system to function well. Information is decentralized. Each one of us knows a little bit about our own profession, or about our own industry, about our own occupation, about our own tastes, and about what our neighbors are doing. There's no single computer out there that can possibly store all of this information, process it, figure out what needs to be done. Lange, on the other hand, said, look, this is just a technical problem. We can solve this technical problem. In many ways, what Leo tried to do was to follow Oscar Lange and to say, okay, suppose that we set up this kind of computer. What would it look like? What sort of input would it take in terms of information from people, and what would it spit out in terms of what people could do? And so by altering the question from the question of what is the best outcome to a process-oriented question, how do I design the rules for social interaction in such a way as to generate desirable outcomes? He changed the whole language and the way we think about things. Now, this was done at some level at the most abstract reaches of economics. Leo was a mathematical economist, and there are about 12 people in the world who can fully understand enough of mathematics and enough of economics to be able to fully understand what Leo is talking about. But it has had a huge effect on the work of day-to-day ordinary economists, because by taking problems and transforming them into understandable mathematical formulations that anybody with, say, a second-year calculus degree could solve, he enabled a lot more people to make much more constructive, important advances. So that was one innovation. We'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a moment. The second innovation, which actually I think is much more important than mechanism design, is the notion of incentive compatibility. So what does this mean? This means that it is unreasonable to set up an economic system that relies upon people acting in anything other than their own self-interest. In this regard, Leo, I think, was following Adam Smith. Adam Smith is well known for Wealth of Nations, but in some ways his more important work is a theory of moral sentiments, which is a work in moral philosophy. And Adam Smith, in that work, said, isn't it a tragedy that people are self-regarding and self-interested and care about themselves, their families, their friends, their neighbors, and so on and so forth? Wouldn't it be wonderful if people cared about everything that happened all across the world? But, well, that's not the world we live in. Let us design systems that work to harness the power of individual self-interest for the power of social good. And that was very profound, and I think it actually influenced Leo in a very profound way, in part because, this is a radical way of contrasting things, we have this Adam Smith vision of the world that says, it's a pity people are the way they are, but given that people are the way they are, let's see what we can do, how we can make the best out of it. There's an alternative vision which somewhat unfairly I will attribute to Vladimir Lenin. So this is the Leninist view of the world, which is people are infinitely plastic, infinitely malleable. Give me three generations and I will make them other regarding. I will make them care about everybody else. I can set up a system where people's fundamental nature can be changed. People get mad when I say this, but here's one reading of 20th century history. We tried it. Not only did we try it, we gave it the best possible shot we could. We killed somewhere between 100 million and 200 million in pursuit of that ideal. Didn't work. It's over. That debate is over. We should move on. That's one way of viewing what humanity tried in the 20th century. And so Leo insisted that the outcomes that you should get out of any mechanism that you design, the outcomes you should expect, are only the outcomes that are incentive compatible. Incentive compatible means that the outcomes that emerge are the outcomes that people think is in their own self-interest. So what he insisted was a useful way of thinking about fundamental problems in fundamental normative problems in social choice and in economics is to think about these problems as problems of designing mechanisms by which we mean something specific, rules of interaction, social interaction among people. Given those kinds of rules, the outcomes that we should design are outcomes which have the property that people will act in their own self-interest. These were dramatic changes. They were particularly enhanced by a very important mathematical result that one of the co-winners of this year's Nobel Prize, Roger Meyerson, came up with. Roger Meyerson came up with two wonderful words, which go with these four, the revelation principle. And what the revelation principle said, it's a remarkable statement, that any mechanism you design, any set of rules for social interaction that you design, can be mimicked by a computer program into which you give the information that you have, and the computer program spits out a recommended course of action. Now, this is not the way we want to set up any kind of practical, actual rules of interaction, but the point is the fact that you could take any mechanism and translate it into this particular specific mechanism made this made the problem of figuring out what the best outcomes are and how we get there a very simple mathematical problem. It's a mathematical problem that, as I said, a second-year calculus student can solve. It's just maximizing a function subject to a bunch of constraints. And lots of bright kids can do that. Even I can do that. So that's the sense in which Leo and then Roger transformed the world, because it enabled people to do a lot more. I'm going to go into some detail, but let me give you some sense of sort of applications of this basic idea. So here's one. Economists have long suspected that there are certain kinds of social problems that decentralized markets will not solve effectively. The classic example of this in this day and age is global warming. Right? That's not something that decentralized markets on their own are going to figure out how to do things, because the incentives are all in one direction. The incentives are all to pollute, to emit the carbon dioxide, and so on, because the costs are borne by 6 billion of our fellow citizens, and the benefits accrue only to a small number of us. And so that calculation could lead to very bad outcomes. So this is a fundamental question. How do you design systems that are going to work in solving that kind of global warming problem? Thanks to Leo's work and thanks to Roger's work, that problem can now be formalized as a straightforward mathematical problem, right? And we can get answers, and maybe in the Q&A we'll debate what those answers are, but you get a bunch of clear answers about what are the right and what are the good things to do, and what are the things that are economically most efficient. A second example is the example of auctions. Over the last 20 years, auctions have proliferated, particularly for PCS and wireless and mobile devices, and for a variety of other things. So governments now auction all of these, the rights to operate these various broadband and other kinds of wireless devices. Governments historically have auctioned off the rights to drill for oil or gas on public lands and so on and so forth. The nagging question always has been, are these auctions designed well? Are they designed well in the sense of getting the right amount of revenue for the government? Are they designed well in terms of ensuring that the right people, the right set of people, most cost-effective people, for example, are operating those networks and are operating that? That's a question that's hard to answer at any level. But the main reason why it's hard to answer is it's hard to know how to formulate this. How do I set this up? How do I decide what is good, what's bad, what's the right person, what's the wrong person? And furthermore, as I change the details of how I conduct the auction, how do I forecast and predict how behavior of people in this auction will change? That's the kind of question that formulating these problems as mechanism design problems makes it straightforward to answer. Now, of course, the answers are only as good as the inputs that go in, right? So if you get the wrong inputs, you're going to get an answer that you don't like. But at least you've got something that you can reduce to a manageable kind of problem. So those are two examples of the sense in which formulating problems as mechanism design problems, recognizing that outcomes must be incentive compatible, has sort of changed the way lots of things work. Let me give you, I was going to go into a technical discussion, but I decided not to. A lot of what Leo did stems from some of the greatest achievements of economic theory are what we call the welfare theorems. These theorems assert, the first welfare theorem asserts, that competitive equilibrium, which is one way of modeling decentralized interaction, is a very good system in the sense that it's what's called Pareto efficient. Pareto efficiency is simply the statement that you can't find a way of making any one person better off without making other people worse off. So this is the best you can do at some level. And so the kinds of questions which have troubled economists are questions like, suppose competitive equilibrium is not the right solution concept. Suppose we don't believe that people are going to behave competitively. Suppose that people don't have all the information that they need. Suppose that competition is not perfect. How would we solve these kinds of problems in these kinds of environments? And Leo Hurwitz said, we can't achieve efficient allocations when we have imperfect competition. But then using Leo's notion of a mechanism, Meyerson argued successfully that we need to change the idea of efficiency. So efficiency now, or good outcomes now to economists, are simply statements of, can you find a mechanism that does better than what I've got? If you can't find a mechanism that does better than what I've got, shut up and sit down. All right? Mechanisms are now central in our thinking about what's good, what's a good outcome. Let me talk about one other example other than the public goods, which is very intriguing and builds directly from Leo's work. This question is a classic question in all societies. All societies have some level of inequality, and all of them always struggle with a simple question. Is the current level of inequality that we have too much, too little, about right? Right? My own view on that is very simple. It is not unequal enough for me personally, and it's too equal for the rest of you guys. So redistributing resources from everybody, not just in this room. We'll all be in the same club. We'll just take everybody behind that tree and transform it and transform their resources to ours. Applying formulating this problem as a mechanism design problem where we want to think about our goals as ones of both minimizing inequality and also maximizing well-being as much as we can. There's a very famous, very nice paper by Andy Atkison and Bob Lucas, another Nobel laureate, who argued that in environments where people know their own abilities, their own skills, their own talents better than outsiders do, inequality is necessary, and not only is it necessary, as people age within as a cohort ages, the inequality of the income distribution across the cohort necessarily must go up. And for those of you who like legacy admissions, there's also an argument for legacy admissions to universities. And that argument is that if parents care about their children, then inequality must grow over generations as well. Why? Because in order to get the incentives right for the parents, you've got to promise them that if things turn out well for them, that if they work hard, if they work smart and so on, not only will they be rewarded, but their children will be rewarded as well. That's how you provide incentives for them. Now, of course, when the children are born, they've done nothing to deserve this. So why'd you give this all these goodies to the kids? And the answer is, it was because I had to give the right incentives to the parents. Now, that's kind of deeper thinking that this whole literature, this whole all of these ideas come up with. I'm sure that you've got lots of questions. Mary talked about the subprime mortgage. So one of the lessons that we've learned from this mechanism design literature is things that, from a static point of view, from a momentary point of view, appear absurdly inefficient. If you think about these from a mechanism design point of view, may in fact be a sensible way of organizing things. So this is a little bit of an extended discourse on subprime mortgages, and then I'll close. Until fairly recently, until the dramatic innovations in financial markets, the vast majority of us, when we wanted a mortgage, went to our local bank or savings and loan, got a mortgage, and went about our business. If things turned out badly for us, then on occasion, would go knock on the banker's window and say, hey, look, I can't pay this. If we can't renegotiate the terms of this mortgage or this loan agreement, then I'm going to have to default. You're going to lose a lot of money from foreclosure and so on and so forth. Any banker faced with that situation, faced with the possibility of getting very little out of the mortgage or settling for something in between, is typically going to find it rational within his own interests to try and come to a mutually agreeable way of settling the problem. But of course, at the time that now comes the interesting way of thinking about things. Of course, at the time that the banker issues the mortgage, he or she understands that down the road, if you get into trouble, we'll renegotiate. And so therefore, the initial terms of the mortgage adjust to reflect the fact that later on, if things turn out badly for you, we'll have some renegotiation. Now, what does all this mean? What this means is that the initial terms of the mortgage are going to be somewhat more unfavorable than they would be in a world where the banker could somehow commit himself or herself to say, I will never renegotiate with you. Now, one of the things that securitization has done, this business of selling off all the mortgages, is that it makes it very, very difficult to negotiate with all the 300 million, there must be that many at least, hedge fund managers out there. Now you stumble over them all over the place. Nowadays they're lying in the gutters, many of them. But anyway, you've got all these guys. How are you going to negotiate with all of them? Because this guy holds 1% of the fifth tranche minus the 18th subordination clause and so on and so forth. It's really hard to negotiate all this. So that leads to what looks, at the time that you're going through it, like a very inefficient outcome. Why can't we renegotiate? Those guys are going to lose. We're going to lose. Why don't we try and come up with a better deal? But the point is that it may well be, I'm not saying it is, it may well be that parceling these mortgages out amongst lots of people may well be a commitment device that enables you to get a better deal up front, knowing that there will be no renegotiation later on. Right, it's that kind of paradoxical thinking that Leo Hurwitz encouraged all through his life and fostered. On Monday, we will have a ceremony at the University of Minnesota, the live feed, where the Consul General will hand Leo his medal and all the rest of it. I like to think that it'll be the fourth or fifth happiest day of my life after the birth of my children and my wedding and so on. But that's what Leo meant to me. Thank you very much.
Oh, Vivi, I would understand economics so much more richly if I had studied more economics from you. Thank you. I want to thank you, too, for making Leo's work so accessible to all of us. Wow, what just an utterly fascinating explanation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You still have the slide up that talks about inequality. And what is the income inequality that we have in the United States that, for everything I've read, seems to be growing? What kind of impact do you think that's going to have on our future?
It's certainly something to worry about. So let me say a couple of things about U.S. experience with inequality. So first, I think it's a good idea to get some of the facts clear in our heads so that we know what has happened. Here's what's happened in the United States. Over the last 50 years or so. If we measure income inequality as the ratio of the incomes that people in the 90th percentile make relative to people in the 10th percentile. So think about ranking all households by income on a line and take people such that who are at the 90th percentile, so 90% of the population is below them, and 10th percentile, so that 10% of the population is below them. That ratio has risen by about 80% or so in the last 25 years after having been essentially flat for about 40 or 50 years. And that's something that a lot of people have remarked on and have worried about and have said, what exactly is going on? What are the deep forces behind this? And so on and so forth. A colleague of mine, Fabrizio Peri, along with one time an alum from Minnesota, Dirk Kruger, did some really fascinating work when they were both at, I think one was at NYU and the other was in Germany, did some really fascinating work looking not at income data, but looking at consumption data. And what they found was that consumption across households has increased, but much, much less so, by about 20% rather than closer to 80%. So what's going on? Here's our best guess based upon that evidence and based upon lots of other evidence that we've gotten about income inequality. What has happened is that the variability, the volatility of incomes at the level of households has increased dramatically. So what has happened is people used to have incomes that wiggled around. Now they bounce around a lot more year to year. Partly it's because of changes in corporate America. Partly it's because of increases in female labor force participation. Partly it's because of changes in the dates at which people retire and so on and so forth. So it's become much more widespread. What this increased volatility at the individual household level means is that if you look at any given period of time, like a year, you will see an increase in income inequality. If you average people's incomes over 3, 4, 5 years, you see a much more muted increase in income inequality. Right? No, just think about the fact that you start with some distribution of people, and if I just tell you that that some people got a 10% raise and some people got a 10% decline, and then they flipped the following year, you'd say averaged over those 2 years, nothing happened. But if you looked at each year, you'd say, wow, inequality went up in each year. So their work, I think, is a useful caution against looking at solely at static measures of income inequality. But even setting that aside, there has been some increase in what we call permanent income inequality, and the candidates that seem most promising and have been investigated are changes in technology, particularly computerization and so on, seem to have increased the rewards to college education, to postgraduate college education, and the rewards to people who are adaptable and capable of learning skills. It's particularly appropriate that I say this in the College of Continuing Education, because it looks as though the people who are willing to learn new tasks, not necessarily people who are skilled in their old tasks, are the people who've been able to adapt to these changes most effectively. And they've had fairly substantial increases in income, and people who have been less willing to adapt have suffered a little bit.
Thanks for that plug. That's what motivates us day by day, too, to help people that way. Back here. Thank you.
Yes. Could you give us some examples of what systems that were successfully designed using these principles?
Sure.
Or failures, either way?
Sure. Okay. So let me give you an example of a system that was successfully designed using a lot of these principles. In the 70s, we passed the Clean Air Act to try and clean up pollution, and the provisions in the Clean Air Act were resisted consistently, particularly by utility companies, which produce effectively acid rain, sulfur dioxide, which then gets converted to acid rain. Economists had been pushing all along for a change in this system. It used to be that the way things worked was the EPA told you how much you could pollute, how much sulfur dioxide you could emit from your smokestack, period. And you couldn't, there was a ceiling, and if you exceeded it, you were fined, and that was all that there was. The utility companies argued very successfully in Congress that making the cap stringent would hurt the economy very severely. They provided estimates from very reliable engineers who had thought about this, a whole bunch of physiologists, right, the cream of the crop, all of whom came up with estimates that said it's going to cost about $600 a ton to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions per ton. Economists said, we don't believe it. And so what we did was, what Congress did was with the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act, they allowed the utility companies to trade sulfur dioxide permits among themselves, right? So if you were emitting very little, you could then sell part of your right to pollute, so to speak, to somebody else. Horrors of horrors, selling rights to pollute. And so there was a market quickly developed where people were buying and selling these rights. The nice thing about markets is they provide an objective measure of what it costs. Those sulfur dioxide permits are now trading for, guess what, $50. Right, okay? So the point is that once you get the utility company's incentives aligned with social incentives in the sense that the utility company is asking constantly, should I reduce my sulfur dioxide by one ton? Well, if I do that, what do I get out of it? What I get is the ability to sell that right to pollute to somebody else. I know how much I'm going to get out of it. I'm not arguing with some bureaucrat from the EPA. I'm not arguing with scientists from the National Academy of Sciences. No. I've got a market. The market tells me, is it worth it or not? And once that happens, then my incentives to overstate the costs, which are very strong in a rigid regulatory system, go away. Now, when it comes to market transactions, I am going to reveal truthfully what my costs are. That's one example of the wonderful things that the system set up. An example of a disaster. I think is a disaster. My colleagues will kill me for saying this. I don't know how many of you have noticed this. The United States is the leader or in the top five in every consumer electronics business across the world, except for one. This one, right? You go to Thailand, you notice when you look at the ads for cell phones, you notice there are no ads which are very popular in America and in the Twin Cities. What's the most popular cell phone ad that you see? Fewer dropped calls than our competitors. You don't see those in Botswana. You don't see that in Thailand. You don't see that in Mexico. You don't see that in New Zealand. You don't see that in India. You don't see that in Germany, all countries I've been to. Why? Because they don't have dropped calls. Doesn't happen. I think that the way we auctioned these permits led to very inefficient outcomes. Now, the people who run these auctions say, no, it's not our fault. Defense Department didn't give us enough bandwidth and so on and so forth. There may be some merit to that, but I think that auction design was not well handled. in substantial part because of the way they set up the regulatory system and the way they limited your ability to transfer those rights to others. And limiting that ability to transfer rights means that there's less competition. And I think the reduced competition accounts in part for the fact that how can we have an industry where we are worse than Argentina? How does that happen? I don't know. Anyway.
I bet half the audience has this slogan running through their minds now. Can you hear me now? Right? Negative ads, huh? We have a question back here.
Yes. There's a lot of economic factors to focus in on, whether it's unemployment, interest rates, the falling dollar, you know, pick one. But that's what I'd like you to do is just pick one, not necessarily on that list, that short list, but pick whatever economic factor is in existence today that you think that we all should be most concerned about and is most troubled at this point. So just as your opinion as an economist.
Great question. The most significant challenge that confronts us as a society is us in the sense of, I look around this room, I see a lot of what are called baby boomers, right? We're all going to be aging, right? this is the pig and the python. It just goes straight through. And so a lot of us are going to be aging. As we age, many of us believe that we have earned the right to a form of leisure that we call retirement. As we age, our demands on the healthcare system will grow exponentially. That's the most significant challenge that confronts us as a society today. So there are two parts of that challenge from the perspective of contemporary U.S. discussions. One part is what's called Social Security, just the retirement component. That part actually, serious, sober look at the data says it's not that big a problem. It is a problem, but it's a problem that can be handled with relatively small adjustments of one kind or another. There's a bigger problem, which is Medicare. That is projected to rise at astronomical rates. And so figuring out how we're going to pay for the health care for all of those old people is a real problem. And that ties in immediately and obviously to the structure of the health insurance system that we have in the United States. That's another example of the application of mechanism design kinds of principles, because information is private, incentives do matter, and resources are scarce. So we need to find better ways of ensuring that healthcare dollars are allocated to people in accord with their incentives to spend that kind of money. And we have a system that provides today, I think, exactly the wrong incentives to every single person. Right? We provide substantial tax subsidies, which induce people to use a lot of healthcare services. And then we complain that people are using a lot of healthcare services and driving up costs. And so what is our remedy? The fact that so many people are using it and so therefore driving up costs and leading some people, the uninsured, not to get as much health care as we would like. Well, let's make the tax subsidies even larger. I'm saying, what? You're going to keep driving demand up. Costs are going to keep going up. It's going to become more and more unaffordable. And your solution to the problem, which is demand is being driven up by a silly system, is to drive demand up even further. It's sort of upside down. So I think that's the biggest challenge. But America has a way of solving all problems. So it's a challenge. It's not a huge problem.
Well, I just have to add an observation here. I think in addition to economic solutions, there are other and social solutions as well. And in fact, in this room, in this building this weekend, we launched a new program called Learning Life. learninglife.umn.edu. Check it out. And we have evidence that if people stay engaged and they continue learning, that they age in a healthier way. So that's what we're betting on. So check it out. So we'll join forces with the economists with some social network solutions as well. But enough of shameless plugging here. I'm sorry. Question over here, please.
I think these are economic questions. I've got two. One is that the United States supposedly has almost a minus savings rate, but yet everybody is contributing to 401ks or some sort of savings plan. And so how can the rate be minus if almost the whole workforce is contributing to a retirement plan? And the second question is, does the size of the national debt worry you?
It's both really good questions. One of the things that there are some statistics that I would rather not see reported because I think that they muddy the fundamental economic issues rather than clarify them. One of those statistics is the so-called personal savings rate. Let me tell you the savings rate that matters, that's important, and that should be computed, it is, and should be reported. And that's the national savings rate, which tells you, as a nation, what was our income over the preceding year, how much did we use to consume today, how much did we use to borrow or pay for stuff abroad, whatever is left over is savings. That's national savings. The thing about the personal savings rate is it's an attempt to ask a completely different question. It's an attempt to ask, how much are you as an individual saving? Now, why is that not helpful? In the United States, unlike in Japan and much of Europe and so on, it turns out that corporations and firms do a lot of their investments through internally financed, in an internally financed fashion. That is, they are saving for us. So now I ask myself, I'm a stockholder. I want to save $10. Does it matter to me whether the companies I invest in save the $10 or whether I invest and save the $10? It doesn't. It's all reflected on the stock price. What matters is the sum total of what I save and what the firms and companies in which I hold stock, equity, bonds, and so on, what they save. The sum of those two is what matters. Now, by that criterion, what has happened over the last 6 to 8 years in particular is that there has been a little bit of a fall in the national savings rate and a little bit of a rise in the consumption rate. How is that all adding up in view of the fact that everybody in this room is contributing to their 401k plans? At the same time that everybody in this room is contributing to their 401k plans, there are a whole bunch of people, I should put it the following way. Whole bunch of us are contributing to our 401k plans, and lots of us use those proceeds and invest it in Ginnie Mae's, Fannie Mae's, mortgage-backed securities. Well, where did those mortgage-backed securities come from? Because there are a whole bunch of other people behind that tree who are borrowing on their homes, on their credit cards, on their automobiles, and so on and so forth. And so we're holding claims against them. So it's their saving plus our saving nets out to a personal savings rate, which is negative. But as I said, national savings rate is still around 16-17%. It's a little bit lower than it has been. And that, so why has that happened? In substantial part, that has happened because of the fact that the rest of the world has been desperately eager for the last 6-7 years to hold a lot of American assets. Right? Okay. Part of the reason for that is that the East Asian crisis in the late 90s taught China, Japan, and the East Asian countries a very painful lesson. The painful lesson they learned from that is if you don't have a lot of liquid cash especially in dollar-denominated and euro-denominated securities, you're going to be vulnerable to outsiders coming in and pulling all their money and destroying your economy. So they have built up a huge portfolio of American assets and American securities. So what does that mean? What that means in practice is, here's what they've done. They've walked up to us and said, here's a Toyota, or here's a Nokia cell phone. In return, would you please give me a share in AT&T or a U.S. government treasury bill? That's the trade we've made. We've gotten all those goods today. In exchange for that, they've gotten all those securities, and we'll have to eventually pay them the dividends and other proceeds from those kinds of securities. So the main reason for the modest increase in U.S. consumption has been this dramatic rise in foreigners' desire to hold American assets. Right. So you've got to remember I'll stop there. Now, you also had a second question, right? Oh, the national debt, yes. So the national debt itself today, so there are several aspects of the national debt. What I like to focus on is what's called the publicly held portion of the national debt. This is the portion of the national debt that's held by people like you and me, pension funds, banks, and the like. And the right way of measuring the debt is not in pure dollar terms, but rather as a fraction of our national income. As a fraction of our national income, the national debt is 40% now. It's about 39 or so. Is that large? Well, let's look at what large means, both in a historical context and in a cross-country context. From a historical perspective, starting from the end of World War II, here's what the pattern of national debt as a fraction of our national income looks like. It starts off at about 106% of national income immediately after the end of World War II. Not surprisingly, we issued a lot of debt to fight a big war. Falls pretty steadily until the late 70s when it reaches a low of about 25%. The level of 40% is comparable to what the national debt was in the early 70s, and quite a bit lower than it was in the mid 60s. The national debt rose under President Reagan, fell a little bit during the time that President Clinton Clinton's administration was in power, and rose initially and now is falling as a fraction of our national income. So from the perspective of history, it doesn't appear to be unduly large. How about from the perspective of how we match up on this dimension with other major industrialized countries? We are well below the median. Japan's national debt is over 100% of GDP. Belgium, Italy, Germany, France, all of these countries are 70% and above. About the only country among the major industrialized countries that has a lower percentage of national debt relative to GDP than we do is the UK. Pretty much everybody else is above us. So we don't look that different. They face much more significant demographic challenges than we do. Their populations are going to age a lot sooner than our populations are going to age. So along those fiscal dimensions, other than the challenge of Medicare, healthcare for the elderly, I don't think that we face significant and serious fiscal challenges.
Interesting. Question back in the center here.
Is there a problem with inequality increasing if incentive design isn't made so that people without power or ability to be in the market don't have adequate incentives to participate in the decisions that are really big, let's say like pollution credits? The incentives are to people who run companies. They're not to low-income folks who can't really decide how they can impact the global warming.
Sure. No, I think that's a very good question. Let me put it in the following stark way. One widespread argument, and I have a lot of sympathy with this argument, is that Latin American countries have had a much more troubled economic history, as we all know, than the United States and Canada for the last 150 years. That's just very well documented. One argument about the source of that instability is that income inequality used to be and still is substantially higher in many Latin American countries than in the United States. So there is an argument that high levels of income inequality foster political problems, foster instability, and that's a real problem. So that's something that is worth looking at. Let me say something specifically about programs that are directed at individuals who currently happen to have low incomes. Incentives matter a huge amount for people with low and moderate incomes. So here's one way of explaining how large incentives are. Here's a trick question. Which group of people in the United States faces the highest marginal tax rate? That is the highest tax rate associated with highest effective tax rate in terms of loss of benefits and everything else if they earn a dollar more of income. Essentially, it's a single mother who is below the poverty line. Because the moment she earns a dollar, then food stamps get cut. The earned income tax credit starts phasing out. Medicaid starts phasing out. A variety of other programs that are available start phasing out. So it depends on the particular individuals you're talking about, but marginal tax rates as high as 60, 70% are very common. It's not very surprising that people who earn that, who face those kinds of steep taxes, rationally choose not to participate in the market. My own view is a lot of those people are crazy, because if I was in their position, I wouldn't look for a job in the first place. And the fact that many of them are, that's really they must dislike working much less than I do, right? Because that's the only way. Because they face very strong disincentives to work. And so an important part of any program that attempts to solve generational cycles of poverty and so on is going to be to find ways of designing programs which don't offer such adverse incentives to the very poor amongst us.
Okay. We've talked a lot about inequality within our country. What's the excessive inequality between countries, especially with the rise of globalization in the last 50 years, in terms of GDP, access to resources, as well as their role in the global economy?
It's a great question. So here is a little known fact, which I like to describe, which is, let's forget for the time being where somebody lives in the world, which country they live in the world. So let's just do the same exercise I was doing earlier. Let's just rank people by their incomes across the whole world, regardless of where they happen to be. So a person in Ethiopia would be down there, a person in India there, Mexico, the United States, and so on. And we look at the distribution of incomes within each group. The last 15 years has witnessed the most dramatic reduction in income inequality across the world that we have ever seen in the history of mankind. Why? Right. There's a simple reason for that. Two countries, two big countries in terms of population, China and India. Right. Okay. So you took a lot of very poor people and made them somewhat less poor. But you took a lot of them. Now, 1.2 billion in one case, a billion in the other case. So that adds up to a lot of bodies. So when you move them up a little bit, that's improved dramatically. More recently, we've seen some very promising signs, even in Africa. So Africa is the horror story of development. The vast majority of African countries became independent of colonial power over some period that ranges basically from 1955. It's done by about 1965, over about a 10-year span. Countries ranging from Kenya to Algeria to Zambia all became independent. Median growth rates in per capita income across all of those African countries that became independent in that time, from then up until 2000, median growth rates in per capita income was zero, which means half of those people were actually poorer in 2000 than they were under colonial regimes. That is the great tragedy of development. What we have seen over the last 6-7 years is somewhat of a reversal. African countries are among the more rapidly growing countries now. We can tell fancy, complicated stories for this, but I think there's a very simple, very straightforward story. In China, the big surge in the Chinese economy occurred starting in 1979. And here's a simple way of describing this. From 1947 to 1979, the Chinese tried an extreme form of central planning. In 1979, being very smart and very capable and having a long history behind them, they said, "This sucker doesn't work." The Russians took 70 years to understand it. The Chinese took 30 years to understand it. And what did they do? They encouraged private ownership, particularly of agricultural produce. They made incentives central. They reduced the role of state-owned enterprises. And they witnessed a remarkable unleashing of the Chinese entrepreneurial spirit. India, which I happen to know personally about, from 1950 to about 1985 or so, suffered from what a prominent economist called the Hindu rate of growth. He said, look, culturally, this is not a people who are willing to invest, save, be enterprising, do all the things that are needed for economic progress to occur. And when he was told, well, look at how successful they are in the U.S. or U.K. or Fiji or Kenya and all that. He said, you take the smartest guys at the top, they're going to do very well. You send them abroad. But the vast majority of us, you know, constitutionally, we're not capable of working hard. And that was called the Hindu rate of growth. And starting in the 80s, particularly with liberalization reforms that Prime Minister Manmohan's, then Finance Minister Manmohan Singh, launched, what they did was opened up their economy, liberalized, allowed people to enter previously closed industries. They're growing at, they started growing at more like 6%. More recently, they're growing at 8.5%, 9% rates of growth. Rates of growth which are, for an extended period of time, close to being unprecedented for large countries. And Japan achieved that for a brief period in the 60s. But you saw this big unleashing. I think that the African governments and countries and societies are beginning to see again the power of individual initiative, the power of aligning incentives, right? And as that happens, as that kind of worldwide revolution happens, I think we're poised for a world where global warming is going to be a huge problem because there are going to be a lot of people wanting to drive those Cadillacs.
I've always had the impression that the value of the dollar was related to the national debt. You've indicated that, gee, our national debt is really quite moderate relative to other nations around the world. So what is it that drives the value of the dollar down, and how far down can it go without there being some significant consequences?
If you know, you and I could go out there and make a killing. This is one of the great unresolved puzzles in international economics. I left it in my I don't know if I have it here. Anyway, I can produce a variety of plots. I might have this here. Excuse me for a moment. There you go. This is a plot of exchange rates between the U.S. and four major European countries, which I aggregated before the euro was created, and sort of called it the euro. What you see is the red line over there. That's the exchange rate, dollars per euro. Now, I've normalized all this so that it's one in 1973. What I want you to note is that basically the dollar appreciated by roughly about 40% from 1980 to 1984, and then from 1984 to 1988, depreciated by another 40%. If you look at this and realize what the scale is, you see extraordinary volatility over a time period when lots of other measures of economic prosperity were all pretty good. It's depreciated when we ran big deficits. It's appreciated when we've run big deficits. It doesn't seem to have any relationship to anything like that. More recently, you can see that there are large fluctuations. The point of these figures is to say that under floating exchange rate systems, for reasons we don't fully understand, exchange rates seem extremely volatile, and a lot of that volatility is not linked in a clear way to fundamentals. Right, okay, so any economist who says, oh, we're running a big trade deficit, and so therefore the dollar will depreciate, or we're running a big trade surplus, therefore the dollar will appreciate, may be right, may be wrong, but he sure as heck ain't looking at the data, at history, to tell you that. He's telling you all that because that's what his opinion is. So it's useful whenever anybody says that to say, and does the data show that? And it doesn't.
So we have a question in the center here.
You mentioned something about the subprime loan issue. I don't know if you consider that to be a major problem or something that will simply work its way out, or if you have some mechanism design thoughts about how it should work out.
Those are good questions. It is a problem for those people whose houses will end up being foreclosed. So it is a problem for them. And the question is, how big is that problem going to be? In terms of the macroeconomy, in terms of other aggregates, I just don't see it, right? Forecasters of various stripes have been forecasting a recession for the last 18 months. Most recently, they forecast that the second quarter would be really bad about a year ago. They're very quiet about those forecasts now because it turned out that the second quarter was the fastest growth rate in the last 4 years. So it's a little bit of egg on your face when you're a forecaster. The factors that I tend to look at when I look at the aggregate economy, which seem to work very well and are consistent with the data, are two things. Productivity. How much do we produce divided by how many hours we put in? And that's growing robustly, as it was from 1948 to 1973. There are fluctuations, but the economy does pretty darn well. When that productivity growth rate is very slow, as it was in the 70s, then we have significant problems. When that productivity growth rate accelerated, as it did starting in the 90s, we have suffered much less in terms of business cycle fluctuations. So productivity growth is a central driver of the magnitude and speed of adjustment of macroeconomic aggregates. And the second thing that I think is very useful is employment, not unemployment. Unemployment is not a helpful statistic because there's a certain sense in which I'm unemployed right now as the CEO of Morgan Stanley. Right? I mean, I'd like to be the... are you... The way that the unemployment statistics are constructed is, are you looking... Are you now searching for... Actively searching for a job? Yes, I'm actively searching for the job as CEO of Citicorp. They're not returning my phone calls, but I'm sure that's just a glitch in the phone line. But in any case, I don't think that's that helpful. What is much more helpful is the employment rate. That's the fraction of the population that's working and how rapidly that's growing or declining. And that's been pretty stable. So those indicators suggest to me that the subprime crisis is not going to have a big effect on the macroeconomy. But, you know, the macroeconomy at the end of the day is made up of little people like us. And there are going to be a lot of little people, maybe as many as a million of us, who are going to have to lose their homes. It's worthwhile thinking about why the vast majority of them are going to lose their homes. They made in 2005 and 2006 a very rational bet. It was a bet that at the time I was kicking myself for not making, which was they saw housing prices skyrocketing. If housing prices are skyrocketing and are expected to skyrocket, what you should do is to go long on housing, get a lot of housing. That's what you ought to do. And then, for a variety of complicated reasons, housing prices started coming down. So a lot of these people made very rational, sensible bets on a particular outcome. One of the unfortunate things about going to Mystic Lake or Las Vegas is sometimes red does turn up, but lots of times it doesn't. And when it doesn't, then, you know, things are going to be bad. At that time, you have an incentive to scream and say, me, I'm just poor old me. What do I know about subprime mortgages and things like that? The hope is that what lenders will do is devise ways of working with borrowers in order to restructure their loans. And I think some of that is already happening. And my guess is we'll see a lot more of that happening over the next few months.
Yeah, could we get back, could sure. you answer some questions along the line of Professor Hurwitz's work?
Sure.
As I recall, the welfare theorems, things like that, were based on relatively simple models, which didn't include anything about the interaction between the economy and the political system. Have there been extensions beyond his work where you include the fact that the political system interacts with the economic system and still develop some sort of insights into fundamentals of markets?
Yeah. So I should say that Leo, he won't personally be able to give this talk at the in Stockholm, but it's being given for him based on a paper that he has written. His health deteriorated abruptly over the last year and a half. But this paper is only 2.5 years old, all right? Okay, so Leo was writing, it's a very high-quality paper. Leo was writing really high-quality papers when he was 88. And I know how he did it. Anyway, the title of that paper is, But Who Will Guard the Guardians? The paper is explicitly about political economy, about political institutions and how you design political institutions. Roger Myerson, who I think of as in many ways as being sort of the intellectual heir to Leo, has been a leader in political economy and in political science. And they're all asking the same kinds of mechanism design kinds of questions. Okay, so at a very narrow level, there are questions like, should we set up a system that has proportional representation? If we set up proportional representation, should it be closed list, open list? Should it be a parliamentary system? Should it be a presidential system? But then there are broader, more ambitious kinds of questions that people are asking about how we structure governments and government agencies. So, for example, one of the things that we've done is for monetary policy, increasingly it is very standard to have an agency, a central bank or monetary authority, which is very independent of the government. So people are now asking deep interesting questions like, should we have a tax authority like a monetary authority that is independent of the government, that is that sets the broad guidelines, or Congress sets the broad guidelines, and then they choose amongst a menu? Should we have something like that? How independent should regulatory agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission be? So, and all of that is all, those kinds of questions are asked by formulating this as a mathematical problem, as a mechanism design problem, and then saying what's the way you'd allocate responsibilities.
We have one question in the back and then a last question in the front here.
What's the connection or a connection, I guess, with the mechanism design theory and John Nash's cooperative theories from 1994 when he won the Nobel Prize?
Not a lot. I can find connections there, but not a huge amount. Even though John Nash, when he came up with the notion of Nash equilibrium, was one of the key people who formalized this idea that people are going to act in their self-interest as they perceive it, and they're going to understand that others act in their own self-interest. This stuff that he did in the 90s deviates considerably from that and goes off in a different direction. I'm not very optimistic about that kind of direction. I'm kind of down on cooperative game theory in general because I think it sort of misses the points that I've tried to make here and the points I think that Leo and others have tried to make, which is hoping to come up with a solution concept that implies the right kind of cooperative behavior in a world with self-interested people is folly. So what does cooperative game theory by and large end up doing? Ends up putting in loose ideas of non-cooperative behavior into cooperative stuff and generally makes a mess out of it. But that's an inside baseball kind of thing. We technically minded people get into these fierce debates about this kind of stuff, and people in my department and in my profession are well aware of my views on this. So the fact that it's on television will not get me into any more trouble than I'm already in.
It seems like the prevailing belief is that economic growth is good, economic decline is bad, but we live on a planet that's finite. The resources are finite, and I'm just wondering how that plays out. It feels like we can't have unlimited growth on a finite planet. Can you comment on that?
Sure. No, that's a great question. Here's the right way of thinking about economic growth. I'm going to use an analogy that's due to a very well-known growth economist, Paul Romer, who's at Stanford. Paul made the following observation. He said, you know, the cavemen 30,000 years ago took ferric oxide, right, as a pigment, and painted on the walls as a way of communicating with each other. Today, we take ferric oxide and make USB sticks. That's so the observation is that economic growth is not an issue of using materials. It's rather finding ways of reusing, using more intelligently, aligning the resources that we have. So the fact that resources are finite does not mean that our economic well-being, properly measured, is limited in any particular way. Fine, we don't have, we run out of oil, that's okay. Maybe we'll find a way of harnessing solar power. When the sun runs out, we'll take off and go to some other sun. So the possibilities for, this is a distinctly American view of the world. The possibilities for human beings are limitless. You're limited only by your imagination and not by your resources, because it's all a statement about how you convert those resources to the most effective kind of use. But I should close by saying something else. Economic growth does not mean and should not be interpreted solely in terms of GDP per capita, because there are some things that are not measured in GDP per capita. One negative, which is not measured, is the effects on the environment. That's obvious. And so to the extent that we inflict harm on the environment and therefore on other human beings, that's a negative that has to be subtracted, right? But at the end of the day, what you care about is a beautiful sunset with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, right? That's what you care about. And economic growth is all, in my judgment, about giving people the time. It's a labor-saving device that allows you the time to enjoy a sunset, listen to Chopin, all right, and see a Jackson Pollock and say, my three-year-old could do that. Let me close on that.
What a lovely way to close with the real contributions of economics. I love it. Feels like this has been a fantastic graduate seminar with some really intelligent graduate students here and an amazing professor. Vivi, we thank you so much. I also hope on Monday when you're with your close friend Leo that you'll let him know that there were a couple hundred people here who now understand his work a lot better, and we appreciate his contributions of his life work, and I hope you'll let him know that we want to honor him too.
I certainly will.
Thank you again. Our next headliners was presaged in a way by some of the comments that Vivi was making tonight. It will be on the effects of global warming. And the faculty member that will be joining us is Deb Swackhammer. Deb is a professor of public health, and she's the new director of the Institute on the Environment here at the university. It's one of the big initiatives that is part of this strategic positioning of the university in a major interdisciplinary effort that Deb is leading. So it's January 10th. In the meantime, I hope you all have a wonderful holiday, and thank you very much for joining us tonight.